Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke. Hello folks, and welcome to another episode of Farming Aotearoa for 2025, sponsored by Rural News, the newspaper that gets the top stories to farmers every week. And once again, we're very pleased to have agricultural journalist Peter Burke in with us today, who works for Rural News. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. It's good. It's spring. Well, it's winter spring, isn't it, really? It's still cold, but we're going to get... The daffodils are starting to come, which is great.
Yeah, I've had daffodils and I've had lambs. I've got little black lambs, little dark brown lambs.
Oh, I love them.
Oh, my goodness, they are so cute.
Lambs are so cute and they grow up to be so ugly, don't they? That's the problem.
Well, I actually think the adults are quite cute as well.
Yeah, some of them are.
Yeah.
Some of them are.
I've got lovely brown ones. I think they're used just for wool.
And some people have lovely cows, which are even more beautiful too.
Yeah.
What's it? Jersey cows always look
pretty. Oh, they're so pretty.
Their eyelashes at you and that sort of thing.
Oh,
they
do.
And I'm getting very nostalgic and very farming. It's time to get back to reality, isn't it? Okay.
You're going to bring us up to date on what's been happening in the past month, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think a couple of interesting things. There's been some conferences, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But one of the stories that I think is fascinating has come out of the education area, where I came across the fact that there's been huge demand in secondary schools around the country for students wanting to learn about agriculture, horticulture, and agribusiness. And what this is prompting is the fact that in the schools, the secondary schools, there aren't the teachers qualified to do that. What we're hearing is that somewhere between, I think it's about 100 schools around the country are teaching agribusiness, and about 200 are teaching horticulture and agriculture. So what has come about this is there's a group called the Agricultural and Horticultural Teachers Association, and they've been working with Massey University, the College of Agriculture and the Environment. And what they're going to do now is to set up some online courses so that they can give teachers who are interested in teaching these subjects some real factual background about it. And this is a very positive sign for the country and for agriculture in general. So much so, I've just had Massey University on the line saying, can we put it up on our website because it's so big? And it's our front page lead in the paper this coming week.
Okay.
So that says quite a lot about it. So what they're doing is Massey and the teachers have worked out what they think is the curriculum. It'll be online, so it'll be, you know, learning as you want to learn it. It'll be about 10 weeks, about 50 hours, I think, of learning involved in it. And teachers will be able to go online and do the various modules that they want to do. They can, if they want to, even cross-credit some of those modules towards another degree, so they can get a diploma. And that's really, you know, I think, an exciting sign. And they're now at the stage of doing a pilot program. They're going to be launching it in the next few weeks. And they'll have a group of teachers who are specialists in the area to go through the program and do it. And once they've got ironed out all the bugs, if you like, and there won't be too many, I wouldn't imagine, but then they'll run this whole thing next year, and it'll be open to any teacher around the country, can go on, do it, and be qualified, and meet the demand, which is amazing, of students wanting to do agriculture and horticulture.
Great.
It is a great thing, and
yeah.
I think it says, I was talking to Professor Paul Kenyon of Massey, who's saying, it now seems that many students are starting to realise that there are very, very good opportunities in the area of agriculture beyond just picking fruit and you know, digging drains and milking cows. There are really some seriously good, high-paying, interesting technical jobs available in those sectors. And that is probably a starting point, which is bodes well for future enrolments, probably at Massey as well. If these young people come through and decide, having done the secondary school subjects, they're very well equipped, I guess, to go and do the degree in, be it agribusiness or whatever it might be. But there are so many different topics around agriculture. People forget it's just not just about the farming things. It's about the technology. It's about innovation. It's about staff management. It's about finance. There is just a multitude of careers in that agriculture, horticulture, agribusiness sector. Many of them go into banking, you know, great. So this is the sort of thing that's coming through that we're going to see happening in the next 6 months probably. And it'll be interesting just to see how this goes. The other thing that's interesting is that with the modules that will be available, teachers doing that can mix and match, if you like, because they might do a couple of, say, agribusiness modules. They might do a couple of hort. They might do a few others. So they can pick and choose what they want to do. So it's a case of the courses are designed not to be one size fits all. You don't just do one thing and that's it. You can pick and choose, and that is really good. The issue really is that what they're saying at the moment is you've got, in a school has, say, got a demand for agriculture, say, horticulture. They've got a teacher who likes gardening, but knowing about gardening is not quite the same as knowing about the intricacies of horticulture and all the things that go with it, soil, the soil sciences, all that stuff. Therefore, they've got to upskill those people with the enthusiasm to be at a stage where they're ahead of the pupils. The plus of this also is that that many of the cases, the resources which teachers are getting as a result of this will be able to be picked up by the students themselves too, because they'll get some extra information they wouldn't otherwise get. So the resources are there. I think it's a wonderful idea, and credit to the teachers. There's a woman, Kerry Allen, up in the Waikato, and another woman, Codette Lowe's from Mount Albert Grammar. And they've been two of the teachers that have been heavily involved in it, and really keen to pilot these things. They've just said that, you know, they've never seen such an upsurge in demand for this before. So there's been a, generally in the past, it's been a struggle to get students to take agriculture and horticulture. Now, thank heavens, the penny's dropped.
That is a good story.
It's a lovely story. I think it's lovely. It's on our front page of the paper this week, so you can, you know, also see that as part of Rural News. If you go to our website, look at it. It's there for you, and I think it's just lovely. I love doing those sort of stories where there's...
I bet you do.
They're positive ones. Yeah. You know, we like to be... I think in Rural News, we're not negative. We like to be positive. We like to put out the good news stories and balance it with the factual stories. But we don't try to be silly and try to go for negative stories all the time. We're trying to be positive, and that's one of them. And it's on the front page, which says a lot about our organisation.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now you had a big conference the other week.
Yeah, big horticultural conference in Wellington. There were 800 people there for that, which was massive.
Wow.
It was the horticultural conference, the annual conference, and it was also a special conference on the OVCs, which is the overseas workers that come in and work in horticulture during the seasons and do seasonal work. But 800 people there was a massive conference, and a very, very good conference, I think, that a lot of positivity coming out of it again. Horticulture, of course, is on the rise. It's a rising star in terms of agriculture. We saw... in June, the prediction in the last year, horticultural exports rose by 19%, which is quite massive. And they're predicted in the next next number of years, to continue to rise. Not so massively as that 19%. It was a big jump. But we're still going to see it, as opposed to some of the other sectors, which are moving positively, but not as big as that. So we had the Minister of Horticulture there, Nicola Greig, who talked about a roadmap designed to build the target of reaching doubling exports by 2035, which is the goal of government. And this idea is what she's saying and said at the conference was, it's about growing sustainability, optimising value, ensuring that Māori are strong in horticulture, and they are. Māori are very strong in horticulture. We're seeing a lot more Māori investing in hort, which is great, especially in kiwifruit, but also in apples and other areas as well. And the aim is to try and just get people to work collectively. You know, it's going to require, she says, strong leadership, which it obviously will to do that. But it's also not a thing that government are actually driving. They're providing what she calls enabling things, such as legislation that enables the horticulture sector to work more efficiently, removing red tape, making deregulation as much as possible without impinging on the environment, those sorts of things. And I thought that was a very positive thing. And there was a lot of positivity just going around the conference, talking to people. I never came across any negativity. It was just all, you know, it's going great. We also heard the chief executive of Hort New Zealand, which sort of represents horticulture, also talk about the idea of collaboration. Now, what you've got in horticulture is interesting. You've got a number of very big players. So you've got Zespri with kiwifruit, you've got apples and pears, and then you've got a whole lot of other smaller groups. You've got what we call product groups. So there's summer fruits, there's tomatoes, there's potatoes, there's all those. And they all have different things. Horticulture New Zealand is not a marketing organisation. It's an advocacy organisation, but it doesn't get involved in marketing, whereas apples and pears, potatoes, all those others do get involved in are interested in trade, and therefore they have a very close relationship with the Horticultural Export Authority, which again is the organisation set up specifically to negotiate or to ensure that there are trading opportunities for horticulture. But Scott was saying, you know, we've got to get collaboration, but we don't have to have a combined voice to government. Every organisation will, product group may have a different view. I mean, you know, they're going to be different because they are different. So they're not trying to, I guess, compartmentalise everyone into one little pigeonhole. But that's the sort of deal. And it's sort of, you know, I think that was a very, very positive aspect of it. Also, we've seen some changes in horticulture. There's a new board coming on board. There's new members coming in. A new chairperson, Bernadine Gliu, and there's some new members coming in. And I think we may or may not see some changes around how the organisation develops, what sort of priorities it sets. I don't know. That's a question of, you know, let's see what happens sort of style. But it's, yeah, interesting there. And also looking at Hort again, we saw an interesting comment from Nicola Willis, the finance minister. She was saying, look, let's get out and celebrate. You know, we need to celebrate success in horticulture. We don't do enough of it. And she's right. We tend to be, New Zealanders are very self-effacing. The Aussies are a bit out there. The Canadians are a bit like us. They're sort of quiet. The Americans are a bit loud. The Aussies are a bit loud. You know, you go along, you watch a cricket match with Aussies there, you know.
Oh, cricket's a different story.
The Kookaburras and the Aussie crowd are
they
the same.
They quiet down a bit at the rugby. But
they do yeah. a bit, yeah, but who knows? They might be crowing a bit at the end of it, who knows? But what she's saying is that when she goes overseas, Nicola Willis, she looks at the New Zealand produce in the supermarket. She goes to them, obviously, when you're on a trip away, you look and see where's the kiwi fruit, where's the apples. And she said, look at them, and the quality is wonderful. We're very lucky. We do a very, very good job. And we don't often celebrate that. Interestingly enough, years ago, I remember New Zealand used to spend an awful lot of money promoting meat in England. The Aussies didn't spend much at all, but what they did was very smart. They bought out a whole lot of billboards at the Heathrow Airport so that when an Australian hopped off the plane at Heathrow, the first thing they saw was eat Australian meat. Now, they did very little other than that. But every Australian came back and said, oh, the Australian meat put it around, great job. We stepped off the plane and guess what we saw? Now, that was interesting that they actually appealed in a funny sort of bizarre way to their mates and they got away with it. So, yeah, a lot there.
There's a lot there, absolutely. Now, you want to talk about the Blairslow Cup?
Yes, I do.
For horticulture.
Yes, that was lovely. It was a great, again, looking at the front page of our paper this week, you'll see a wonderful picture of Andrew Fenton, who was awarded the Blairslow Cup. This is the pinnacle of excellence in horticulture. There are actually, I'm told there are, I think there are five Blairslow Cups. There are three for Ahu Whenua. Oh, sorry, there are six. Three for Ahu Whenua, one for horticulture, one for rugby, and one for chess. Blairslow donated one for chess. How's that for a bit of a relevant information to brighten up your day?
There's a bit of trivia for our show.
I love trivia. It's great. You know, I thrive on trivia. and I write a bit about it too. But Andrew Fenton was a very, very popular winner in this sense. He was, he's been involved in the kiwi fruit industry right since the early days in the 1970s. And right from day one, Andrew has been involved in, I guess, the industry good organisations. He's been chair of the Te Puke Kiwi Fruit Growers. He became chair of Horticulture New Zealand when it finally came into being back in, I think, 2005. He's been a wonderful, and he's a lovely guy. He's a really nice, pleasant, lovely individual. He was rather funny when he got the cup. He said, I've been duped. He said, I was invited here to speak about 20 years of horticulture. He said, my wife was insistent that we go to this conference. He said, I couldn't work out why she was so keen to go to a conference like this. And he said, I was duped into coming here. And he was, obviously, but I think it was a lovely sense of feeling around the place. Everyone thought that Andrew was a very, very worthy recipient of it. And it's a great thing for him. It's a great thing for horticulture. And I think it, again, raises the issue of the importance of celebrating people's contribution in ways other than by the gongs that they get. I think being recognised by your peers, to me, is a pretty special thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's sort of, for me, I don't know, I'm not criticising the other awards, but I think when you receive one from your peers who say that you're the best in our area, that's something that is pretty good. And Andrew was certainly the recipient of that. Lovely guy, great picture. See the front page of our paper, you'll see it there. So that's another lovely piece of the... And again, I just was sort of blown away by the positivity of the conference, which was, yeah, I mean, you go to a lot of conferences and there's a few moans and gristles and a bit of, you know, and all that. But this was big. It was held in this place called Takina in Wellington, which is the big conference centre, and it's big. And that was a big dinner that night. They had, I don't know how many for dinner, it must have been 400 or 500 there for the dinner, which was huge.
Gee, it's big dinner, yeah.
So, yeah, we're big. Then there's another Bledisloe Cup. What could you ask for more? Two Bledisloe Cups on the podium that
night.
Yeah,
there you go.
As well as the Bledisloe Cup, which was the main centre opinion of the night, the Ahu Whenua organisation launched its competition for horticulture for next year. So next year, there will be a Bledisloe Cup available for the top Māori orchardist, horticulturist of the year, and the top Māori young grower of the year. And we managed to bring along the very beautiful Ahu Whenua Cup that was there beside the other Bledisloe, and the head of Te Tima Pairua, Dr. Charlotte Severn, launched that. And just to put in front of people, partly to say to them, you probably know of some young person in your teams that might be a Māori, young Māori farmer, young Māori orchardist who could qualify for the award, or you might be part of an orchard or part of a trust that has got something to offer. And so that was another nice piece of the jigsaw puzzle at the conference.
So now talk to me then about tariffs and trade.
Yeah.
The US.
So the final speaker of the event really was Todd McClay, the trade minister, who gave a long, I guess, quite a detailed briefing on what's happening with the United States. He had just come back from there, having met with some of the officials in the Trump administration to see whether we couldn't get a reduction in that 15% or to understand why it was imposed. It seems that there was an arbitrary decision made by the president. And in fact, what he's saying is that some of the officials said, well, look, we like you guys. You're a great country. We have nothing against New Zealand, but the president made a decision. In other words, I suspect that, you know, that Donald Trump in his own particular way, without any great wave of intellect, made a decision. But no one said that except me. But so he was saying that you know, this is still an issue for us, although I saw today that someone was saying that because there's a big tariff being imposed on India, that New Zealand wool exports to the United States will become more profitable, which is interesting. There's swings and roundabouts in this tariff thing. But what they're doing at the moment is MFAT is going to, I gather, set up an organisation which will spend time just looking at what we call these non-tariff trade barrier issues, which are this part, and also going up to Washington on a regular basis to meet with the officials to see how this thing can unravel. There's a question mark around if, for example, the reason we've got the 15% is because there's a trade imbalance in our favour to America. If that changed, would the tariffs change? No one's clear about that yet. And I think what everyone's trying to do is to try and get some idea of where that sits. So the tariff issue is a big one. It might sound outside the realm of many people, but it affects the prices, the returns to growers, to farmers, to everyone in New Zealand. Therefore, it does affect the economy. And also on that front, we're seeing the Horticultural Export Authority, Simon Hegarty, who's the CEO there, again concerned about these tariffs, saying that, you know, we export about... Well, America exports New Zealand a lot of stuff. They don't get it with any tariff at all. They get here tariff free. So why are we being hit?
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, and you know, he's saying it's unjustified, and he's right. You know, and the feeling is that this tariffs could lead to a slowdown in purchasing of New Zealand product. How much? Who knows? But if depending where the tariff falls, is it going to fall back on the exporter, or is it going to fall back on the customer? If it gets too expensive for the customer, will they continue to buy? I don't know. That's sort of, you know. It's the same for the dairy sector as well. They're both they're in these two organisations particularly are involved, and meat as well, of course. But you know, there just seems to be some inequality in the way it's been applied, which is rather crude, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. It's not much finesse in it. But what this has done for dairy in particular is to actually give the EU an advantage over New Zealand exports to the United States, which I don't think anyone really would want to intend to do, but it has resulted in that because it's the way that they've gone. So there's still a lot of unhappiness, a lot of disappointment around the sector at the moment, and I think it's creating uncertainty. And the issue really for Macleay and others, officials, is to try and get some certainty back into this whole system. What's going to be, you know, how can we get some certainty out of these guys? Can they be talked around? But one doesn't sense that there's too many good ears in Washington at the moment. They're big, but they're not listenable.
Anyway. I think that goes across the board.
It does, and you know, there's a interesting thing there.
All right, now tell me about one of, certainly someone that you say is one of the nicest people you've ever met, Philippa Wright.
Yeah, Philippa Wright has run a wool broking business called Wright Wool in the little central Hawke's Bay town of Waipakarau for 28 years, I think, actually. But she's been in it since she was literally left school. Her father was a wool classer. She started working in a wool shed, being a rousey, as it were, and then she ended up working for some of the big wool companies up in Hawke's Bay and eventually bought her own business. And she's been one of the most lovely people I've ever dealt with. You pick out a few people that you really like. I mean, I like Lockwood Smith, for example. He's a brilliant politician. And Philippa is a lovely, equally lovely individual to deal with. Pleasant, reasonable, and very successful at what she does. But after all these years, she's bailed out. I know, I couldn't help with these puns of mine, but anyway. But she had some interesting comments to make, I think, and I think they're really ones which I can really resonate with. One of the things she's saying is that the idea of this of the carbon footprint, putting land into trees, is taking away land that should otherwise be used for wool production. So therefore, the amount of wool being produced will drop. That's a pity, because That's not what we really want to be. After all, our first exports from New Zealand were actually wool. They weren't meat. It wasn't until Dunedin came along with refrigeration that we actually started to export meat. But prior to that, it was wool. The other thing, I think, and I'm very strong about it myself, is that back in 2003, farmers, for some unknown reason, some hormonal rush must have come across them, they decided to abolish the wool board because they thought it wasn't working well. Well, sometimes it pays to repair a car rather than just take it to the dump. And I think that decision was one of the most inept decisions I've seen in New Zealand agriculture in my 60-odd years around it. I think it was a dumb one, probably the dumbest one of the lot, because what it did was it took away the advocacy for New Zealand of wool. It left it with nothing. It was a desert. And since then, the wool industry has struggled. It's come up, there's been Merino have done their own thing and so on. But by and large, it's had a major impact. And I think combined with that issue of now we've got of less land being available, I don't think farmers should be complaining too much. They were the idiots that did it. And I'm not apologising word idiot. They were stupid. I actually went in my early days as a journalist to Europe and to see what was being done in research. It was very, very good. Wool was really top of the notch. And I just cried a day to see what happened through some, I don't know, bizarre, as Philippa Wright said, she was gobsmacked to see when that happened, because it would have been easy. Sure, things mightn't have been right with the wool board, but they weren't unfixable, you know? A couple of flat tyres doesn't mean to say you've got to buy a new car.
Yeah. I'd like to see trees and sheep at the same time. Sheep love to sit underneath trees.
I don't disagree with you.
There won't be as many trees as what you'd like.
No, but forest farming was a big thing back in the 80s, and there was a lot of work done with that. And I think there are still things that are right about trees.
Yeah.
I think sheep, all animals should have shade.
They should. They absolutely should.
And I don't agree with
you. You give them the choice, you see where they are.
Exactly.
Shade or protection from even though they're woolly,
yeah.
The sheep that I see in my paddocks next to me, straight under the trees when it rains.
Exactly. I've seen the same on my farm too. So I think that you're absolutely correct on that one.
And they're not very tall. So
no, and you know,
it won't take long for the trees to grow up so they don't eat them.
No, no way. I mean, I've had the trees there. So just to say, you know, farewell, Philippa, but I think she's made an incredible contribution to the wool industry in New Zealand. She's been a great advocate. She's got out there and promoted wool. She's done the hard mahi there. And I just think we've lost in the sector someone who I think is a really great individual and deserves to be recognised perhaps more than perhaps she has been. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great to see. I think she attacked the glass ceiling at a time when it was very difficult for women. She was in there when the wool industry was the old boys network. And for her to get to rise up, then to buy into a business and run it successfully was an incredible achievement in my view. And you know, I'll be in touch with Philip all the time because she's just a lovely individual.
That's a great
story. So, you know, you just get some people in your life and you think, over 60 years in the media, who do I rate highly?
And she's
one of those that fit in my top 10.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really nice.
Just to talk a little bit about the issue of what I call academic freedom. Now, this has arisen in the last week or two with comments by Mike Joy, who's an environmentalist and who, under the umbrella, if you like, of academic freedom, has always been anti-dairying, and that's fine, although he actually has worked on a dairy farm, I might add, but that's all right. But he said something to the effect that that the dairy industry was killing babies and that the CEOs of the dairy industry should maybe be hung for what they're doing.
There's some strong words there.
I thought it was.
It's very violent.
I thought it was, and he then came back after being federated farmers got up and said, this is not right. He said, oh, well, it was only tongue-in-cheek. Well, my view of that is that if I went to the airport tomorrow and said, as I went through, I've got a bomb in my bag,
I
said, oh, it's only tongue-in-cheek, I know where I'd be for the next five nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a very stupid... It wasn't just an off-the-cuff comment. That was close to being one that maybe the law could investigate.
Yeah, you got to watch what you say. That's
you do, don't you? I mean, there was no... The days of being funny, in that sense, have to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
Now, he says it's all, and he was a bit, his comments to first of all say, oh, you know, it was only just tongue-in-cheek. Then he came back a few hours later saying, I fully apologise, I was wrong. The university came back and said it was wrong. But there were farmers that were saying, hang on a bit, if that was us doing that, what might have happened? Would someone, for making a threat like that, be still in a job? Or be suspended? I don't know. I'm not saying should be. I'm saying the question is being asked. One of the people that I talked to about this was a guy, a very, very special person called Sir Lockwood Smith, who was, he's an academic by background, got his degree, a PhD at Adelaide, became an MP, Minister of Agriculture, Trade, Education, etc., Speaker of the House, High Commissioner to London. And he says academic freedom is a privilege. And when it's put at risk when people abuse it. And he was saying it's a privilege. And I think that's something that maybe some academics don't always understand. They think they've got a God-given right to blurt out what they think, but they should stay within their subject area. And I'm not against academic freedom. I think it's a good thing. It's the right thing. We should have academics who are free to give candid advice on subjects. It's when you walk over the line. And this is, I think, a case where the line has been walked over with interest. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But I thought that, you know, Sir Lockwood saying it's a privilege. It's a privilege, not just a right. And it's the same as parliamentary privilege in our democracy, where parliamentarians have the right to do that. So I think it's just a story to keep your ear, just keep listening to it, think what's happening, and think about it. It's something we need to, because it's a serious ending. But it's an important ending because freedom of speech is important. It's what is over the line, what's over the top, what's reasonable. I think that's what we want democracy. I have different views to others. So be it.
Nothing wrong with a good discussion with someone.
No, it's a good discussion, but it's got to be
respectful of
other
people.
It should be the topic, not the individual. It's the policy, not the individual that should be targeted. And I think this is where it's targeted the individual, which is wrong.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in and giving us the update of what's been happening. Good to see you in the studio.
Nice to be in the studio, and I'll be back in a month's time, probably.
Hope so. See you then.
See you then. Bye.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.